Rules Committee is in session, and welcome, everybody. Today is, happens to be the 19th day of 2012 for January, and it is, okay, I got like 2:09 p.m. Good. Hey, welcome, everybody. Okay.
Hi.
Wow.
The usual response from the Rules Committee.
Okay, well, we're going to, members, what we're going to do is actually go through, open up an informational portion of this committee today and have the invited testimony come up and share. Then we'll close that, and then we'll go into a work session, just give you some heads up, and then move forward for the bills that are identified there as a block, and then move them as committee bills. And then we'll just kind of explain that a little bit more. So at this point, I'm going to open up informational hearing on a number of bills that are listed. And I think the first person I'd like to have, see, Senator Edwards isn't here. So John Ruiz, manager of City of Eugene, if you'd come forward. And actually, do you want, are you in a position, Patrick, to give a little bit of brief history of what the bill is?
Mr. Chair, I can give a very brief summary. How about that? It's just to kind of start us off. LC 183 allows the owner of a territory that is not contiguous to a city to annex that to the city if the land is within 500 feet of the existing city boundary and the city was under the jurisdiction of a boundary commission on January 1st, 2007. Measure would sunset on July 1st, 2014.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Kotek and members of the committee. My name is John Reese, and I'm the city manager for the City of Eugene, and I am here in support of Legislative Concept 183. We have two neighborhoods in Eugene, the River Road and the Santa Clara neighborhoods. They're unincorporated, but they're both within the urban growth boundary of Eugene. And for decades, people in both of those neighborhoods could annex and had the opportunity to annex into the city without being contiguous to city limits. In 2007, the state dissolved the Boundary Commission, and one of the unintended consequences was to take away a tool that allowed non-contiguous property owners to annex into the city. Eugene's situation is unique in the state. And this legislative concept that you're contemplating would reinstate this tool that would help in this unique situation by allowing non-contiguous property owners a window of time to annex into the city if they choose to. It would only apply to Lane County, and it would open up a conversation for a long-term discussion and solution for both River Road and Santa Clara neighborhoods. We are currently in discussion with several special districts in both of those neighborhoods to ensure smooth transition of services if property owners choose to annex into the city. And we need this tool, and I would ask for your support. And I'm available for questions.
Okay, any questions? Representative Esquivel.
On this 500 feet, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the 500 feet, let's say I'm 500 feet away from being contiguous to the city, I annex into the city. Do I have a contract annexation process then, or do I get infrastructure out to me at that point since I am in the city? If so, who pays for the 500 feet?
Chair Olson and Chair Kotek and Representative Esquivel. As I understand your question, if somebody chooses that within the 500 feet to annex into the city, one who pays for the services that would come into the city, was that part of your question?
Well, I'm 500 feet away
okay.
from the infrastructure, maybe the sewer, the water, whatever. Now, also, and I don't know what this these neighborhoods look like, whether they have sidewalks or not, but, you know, we require sidewalks to be put in, we require sewage, we require the infrastructure from the city itself, because that's what you're paying for. What about the people that are in between the 500 feet, your property and the city? Do they have to pay part of that, or is it just me, the individual, and they get off the hook and later on annex in and bypass that?
What happened, first of all, they would not be required to put in curbs and gutters and sidewalks if they currently don't have that. By virtue of just annexing into the city, now if they're contiguous and they annex into the city, they do not have immediate requirements to do those kinds of things. Those two neighborhoods are semi-rural neighborhoods and have a unique character within the community, and actually for the long-term future, I suspect those neighborhoods may maintain a good part of that semi-rural feel, even as they annex into the city over time. So they would be treated like any other property that annexes into the city with respect to services. So services could be extended. If they need to be extended out to there, they would pay for their appropriate share of those services, water and sewer. Either the utility or the city would pay for our appropriate share, just as we would with any other annexed property.
I'm just trying to set it in my own mind how this works.
Okay.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and thank you for being here today. I've had a little bit of experience on a local city council and dealt with some local land use issues. And what I'd like to say today is not specific to the Eugene situation, but more specific to the land use system we have in Oregon that is sort of a one-size-fits-all. And this is just yet another example of how that doesn't work. And I'm always cautious to do a small area carve-out for one little area or one community instead of looking at the greater problem of fixing the land use system and allow regions and areas of our state to have a little more flexibility in the way their land use works. So I appreciate your problem. I've sat through many issues around cities' annexation issues. Maybe this is such a thing we can, over a small period of time, help one community, but I think as a legislature, we need to be aware that these situations happen all around the state, and we need to get back to the intent of our land use system, which was a regionalized land use system. So thank you for being here today, and I think we have a challenge as a legislature to keep in mind there's some work to be done here.
Yeah. Representative Berger.
Ditto everything you said, Representative Freeman, but I do remember being around when we went when we did away with the Boundary Commission that was unique to Eugene and was sort of a extra layer that they had, and there was a lot of controversy about, you know, us coming in and saying, oh, well, Eugene, you have this funny thing, we're going to take it away because some wanted it, some didn't. And I'm not surprised there were unintended consequences of that within Eugene's sort of unique construct. And Representative Beyer remembers this very well. It was like, what? I appreciate, I'm almost a little surprised there wasn't more unintended consequences. Maybe that shows our wisdom? Oh, I'm not going to go there.
Colleagues, you might be kind of wondering why we're listening to this here in rules right now, but at the end of last session, a gentleman by the name of Bob Getty down there in the Eugene area, along with Senator Chris Edwards, were trying to move this bill into the Rules Committee, and we just ran out of time is what it boiled down to. And that's what we have today is exactly the mirrored language of what were the -3 amendments to another bill. Mm-hmm. So, Representative Beyer.
Thank you. Do you see this as just pertaining to the Eugene-Springfield area? When I first looked at it, I guess I figured it was a little broader than that, but can you clarify?
Representatives, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Tech and Representative Beyer, my understanding it would apply to Lane County only.
Okay.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do remember this issue from last session because it originated in a committee that I was co-chair of, and we punted it at the end because we ran out of time trying to solve this problem with the -3 amendment. So I appreciate you bringing this back in this form. I was sort of curious about one aspect of this, and that would be if it has any impacts to other small cities in Lane County, you know, Bonita, Cottage Grove, or have they had a chance to weigh in on any implications this may have for them?
Chairs Olson and Kotek and Representative Holby, I don't know the implications for other communities in Lane County specifically.
Yeah, thank you. And a follow-up, and I do appreciate the problem, and as Representative Berger pointed out, it did come, some of these problems came from the legislature abolishing the Boundary Commission and trying to make our state a little bit more uniform across the state, and it did create a lot of problems. And in this particular case, Mr. Getty wanted to develop some property that was vacant that he owned for many years and was within the urban growth boundary, yet could not get a building permit because his land wasn't annexed, and he couldn't legally annex his land. And so I appreciate that this solution does help infill that property, potentially if owners want to do that, within the urban growth boundary to help, you know, coincide with our land use goals. It's difficult to get annexation and land use goals to be on the same page all the time, so I appreciate this attempt at solving part of that problem for this area anyway. Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's very, very imperative that we state that this only pertains to Lane County, because let's say that we had a situation in a different municipality that did a contiguous only annexation process, and then somebody goes, well, wait a minute here, it's in the law, I can do this, which is contrary to the specific city. How do we know that this is specific for Lane County?
Chairs Olson and Kotek, Representative Esquivel. I don't know what the specific language says in here. My understanding, it applies directly to Lane County and Lane County only.
Well, but I mean, if I, excuse me, a follow-up?
Is it specifically say Lane County?
Yeah. If I may,
go ahead.
In section one of the bill, right, if you look on the second page under
section one of the bill.
Section one, subsection two,
To be.
City. It refers to the Boundary Commission formed under ORS 199-410.
So that only pertains to the
Lane
commission.
County.
And there was only one. There was only one county.
Right.
That's
there you go.
Lane
that's
county.
The one. I wasn't seeing where it was specific, and I was thinking, well, you know, I think we have 13 or 14 different ways to annex in the state of Oregon with the municipalities, and they all do it different.
But Lane County was the only one that had a Boundary Commission described there.
Right. Mr. Chair, and I just want to apologize because after it was pointed out to me, I saw that.
Pay
a little more closer.
You wouldn't
closer
want unless
attention.
You looked that up. All right,
any other questions?
I don't remember that one.
Okay, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Mark Landauer. That's a good bill. And if you would please identify yourself.
Will do. Thank you. Co-Chair Kotek, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Mark Landauer. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and I'd like to say at the outset, and I appreciate that Co-Chair Olson mentioned Mr. Getty, I think that the primary impetus of this bill is pertaining to Mr. Getty's predicament, and I suspect that Representative Holvey would confirm that. I want to make it very clear that, you know, Mr. Getty is sort of has been marooned, if you will, through no fault of his own. And we're certainly sympathetic with the predicament that he faces. And, you know, generally we are supportive of allowing a landowner to develop their property. However, this draft that's before you today raises several concerns for special districts. And we also have a couple questions regarding the draft as it's presently constructed. I'd like to just point out a couple particular concerns that we have, if I may. And Section 1, Sub 2 voids ORS 195-205 through 195-225 and also 222.111 through 0.180 for this new type of annexation. As a result, we believe that the following current requirements of the statute would no longer apply, and those requirements include that consent statements be not older than 1 year or have a specified time period, the requirement for a city to provide information on taxes and other costs to the property owners. And it also appears that the requirement for public hearings under these types of annexations would be waived. As a result, adjacent property owners would have potentially no idea that a neighbor is being annexed into a territory. Why is that problematic? Well, that it becomes problematic because if those neighbors, as a result of this type of annexation, become encircled by city boundaries, they can, of course, be annexed by the city without any vote whatsoever. The city can annex that territory. So nothing in this bill prohibits island annexations that result from this type of an annexation. Secondly, if you'll imagine in this area that we're discussing, the River Road, Santa Clara area, there are a number of incorporated islands. And those incorporated islands, as I read the bill, potentially could create what I've termed leapfrog annexations, because the bill says that if somebody wants to get annexed into the city, all they have to do is be within 500 feet of the city boundary. Well, imagine, if you will, there is an island of a couple property owners that are far removed from the contiguous boundaries of the city, and somebody wants to annex into the city, and they're within that 500 feet of that island, incorporated island, all you're doing is creating an additional island. Districts are very concerned that these types of annexations contemplated in the draft could be within a district's master plan as well, and agreed to by an adopted urban service agreement, but this draft appears to void those considerations as required in ORS 195. As a result, the bill could be read to allow annexations not agreed to or approved in an urban service agreement. SDL believes that this new type of annexation should not overrule existing or future urban service agreements. I want to make it very clear that in the River Road area, there is a park and rec district called River Road Park and Recreation District. It is a very popular park and rec district with the citizens in that area. Over time, the city has annexed into this district, and it has made the financial stability of this district rather precarious. As annexations continue and have continued, the Park and Rec District ultimately had to put out a levy in order to maintain their service levels to the citizens that they serve. All this bill would do would continue to undermine the financial viability of this beloved Park and Rec District. In addition, I'd like to just mention a few other concerns and then just pose a question that I frankly can't answer. Section 1, sub 2 of the bill on line 22 of the page contains a phrase, or another consent to annexation. We don't know what this other form of annexation is, and believe it at a minimum ought to be stricken from the current draft. This section, those words, would imply that a signed or written consent is not necessary if another consent to annexation is agreed upon. Does this mean a verbal consent or a consent by an expired agreement is allowable under the bill? We believe that these agreements need to be signed, they need to be in writing, and consistent with the consent agreements that are currently contained in ORS 222. The final concern that we have is that we believe this bill sets up a pretty scary precedent. There are a number of these types of areas throughout the state, and we're concerned that people with similar problems are simply going to come to the legislature and ask for similar legislation, and we will have these types of bills before us again. There, similar communities in the state include Medford, Portland, Beaverton, and of course, Eugene as well. Final point, and it's really posed as a question to the supporters of this bill. What we at SDAO don't understand fully at this point is what is preventing the city from extending services outside of the city boundary in Eugene. Is it due to a charter requirement, or is it due to an ordinance or policy of the city? If it's the latter, the city has the ability to extend those services without this bill. I have had several conversations with representatives of the city of Eugene, in particular the lobbyist. Again, as I stated, we are sympathetic with this particular landowner's dilemma, and I will continue to do continue those conversations with the city of Eugene, so that in the hopes that we can find a mutually agreeable solution. But as drafted at this point, we have several concerns with it, with this measure, and we'll certainly make those known if and when this bill is considered by whatever committee gets it. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Representative Holby.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your concern, and you know, this is a difficult topic, as always annexation is. But specifically to your concern about the subsection that you brought up.
Subsection two
of section one.
Line 22, is that correct?
Well, in my draft, it's on the second page on line two. But that whole subsection two, you know, lays out the, you know, scenario, and you're making the claim that that subsection A of that subsection two, no, I'm not saying that correctly, but that could apply all over the state to Medford. But if in fact you read B and C, all of those go together.
Yes.
So it also can't apply to a city that wasn't annexed under the jurisdiction of the Boundary Commission. So that point would not apply to Medford because they did not have a Boundary Commission.
I apologize if you misunderstood me, Chair Olson, Co-Chair Kotek. Representative Holby, my point there actually wasn't necessarily that this bill would apply to Medford or Portland or Beaverton. What I was trying to articulate was that there are similar island incorporated areas throughout the state, and this bill sets a precedent. What I was referring to in section 1 sub 2, as you are correct, line 2, where it says another consent to annexation.
Mm-hmm.
The concern there, again, was that we're not clear what that another type of consent is, whether that is a verbal consent, whether it is an expired consent for annexation. That another type of consent is not defined in the bill. That was the concern I was trying to articulate, and I apologize if I misspoke.
Very good. Further, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to close the public or informational hearing. Thank you on LC 183 and open up an informational hearing on LC 198. Let's just
okay.
Move forward since everybody's here.
Sorry.
You want to just share a little bit?
Oh, Patrick, 198. Chair, yes, thank you. LC 198 is not currently available, so I don't have any particular details on it, but I believe folks who have lined up will come and speak to it. Mr. Chair, as a result of it not being available for the committee, it won't be introduced today, is my understanding. So the power.
So we're just actually just going to kind of the folks that are here that are interested in it. We're just going to invite them up, and if you remember, members, this was a bill that came in at the very end of the last session, It had been in another committee and died, and it actually, for a better term, I call it the EFU doggy bill. So, but I mean, what we did was, if you remember, we heard testimony at the end of last session, and then what happened is that we ran out of time, thought there were some fixes that could be corrected, and we did that during the off season, and now we've come back with a modified version. You're going to get an opportunity right now just to kind of listen a little bit. We're not going to move it as a committee bill today, but those that are here, would like to invite them to come up. So, Patty, if you want to come on up, and Sean, if you want to come on up too. Troy, are you? Do you have any in?
No.
Okay.
He's not covered.
Co-chairs Kotek and Olson, thank you, and the committee members, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to come back with this bill. It was...
If you'd identify yourself, Patty.
I'm sorry, Patty Strand, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. We did work very hard on this bill, but it seemed like all of last session, I think we had three or four hearings in a couple of different committees, and as Representative Olson said at the end of it, there were a number of different fixes that we all agreed should happen. It was one of those bills where everybody supported the goals, but we couldn't quite figure out how to get there. And so, as Representative Olson has said, he worked with us in the off session. We're so thankful for that. And we got all the parties together that had an interest in this. We worked with the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, with the Farm Bureau, with Sean Cleave. And we believe that we now have a product that can go forward and will accomplish all of our goals without treading on some other issues that are important as well. And so I think that you have maybe some amendments that were recommendations for amendments that were sent forward last week from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. We have seen them. We think that they're fine. They don't undermine our intent in any way at all. We're happy with them. And so I guess it's a matter of getting a new product together to look at. So thank you very much. We are so appreciative. You know, Oregon has one of the highest dog ownership rates in the United States. We have about 40% of households here have a dog. That's 550,000 households. And the economic impact of dog ownership in the state is, when you're just looking at the events and the activities of the organized dog people, about $18 million. And they are, to the degree that we work with them, and there's 103 kennel clubs we work with, they are very excited and hopeful about this bill. So thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Chair Kotek, Chair Olson, thank you for having me today. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau did have some objections to the bill last session. Those objections were consistent with Oregon Farm Bureau's policy regarding minimizing conflicts in the EFU. We did have some concerns, and I believe I've articulated those concerns to a number of you. Thankfully, we were able to work in conjunction with Ms. Strand and you, Representative Olson, over the interim to draft a bill I think that the Oregon Farm Bureau can be neutral on. I think that the language that was provided with in conjunction with Oregon Department of Agriculture and LCDC go far to minimize those conflicts that we spoke of and draft the language in the correct area of statute, which was the major issue as drafted last session.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Coach. I hate to be slowing this committee down, but I remember this well, and I'm just dying of curiosity to know what section of ORS we put these dog activities in.
There's subsection one for what we did was we limited the number of dogs that could participate in dog training classes to 10, and we limited the number of dogs that could be present at a testing trial to 60 for the subsection one, and then for conditional use, if you have a testing operation that's bigger than that, or if you have more than 10 dogs. So the conditional use will apply just there.
And Chair Kotek, Chair Olson, Representative Holvey, to your question specifically, the prior draft was in the EFU tax section, which is a separate and distinct draft from the EFU uses statute, which actually has two components that any one of the 36 counties in Oregon can be organized under. As an aside to that, I've been having conversations with various interested parties, perhaps simplifying Oregon's EFU statute by condensing those two separate mirror statutes into just one statute so that it would eliminate Scrimner's errors moving forward, hopefully. I think there is some interested parties in moving forward perhaps next full session with a bill that would be more housekeeping in nature so that issues like this wouldn't happen as frequently, or that language that needed to be duplicated in both sections of current statute would be actually mirrored, or not needed to be mirrored, just be in one area of statute. So maybe that's a conversation for another day, but...
Okay, you're good.
Well, right. Specific, but I'll be anxious to see the LC.
Co-chair.
Co-chair.
And if I can clarify, you know, I'm just looking at our agenda for today. There might be some confusion. I think the parties have been working together on an LC draft, and then we had some, you know, miscommunication. Did we have everything we need in the draft? That's why we don't have it to introduce today. So. Rules has slightly different. The Rules Committee can do this when we are back in session on the 1st. But I think the relating clause is going to be relating to dog training facilities, not relating to agricultural land, which is what is on the agenda today. I don't know why we had that switch, because we're trying to make sure that the relating clause is very specific to the issue.
Okay. And I can speak to that, Chair Kotek. Again, Sean Cleave representing Oregon Farm Bureau. The draft that we saw early on dealt with a variety of issues that were specific to the dog training. 4 years ago, Oregon Farm Bureau did have a bill that actually did speak to cleaning up 215, 286, and the corresponding marginal lands statute, unless I have those flipped. I believe that's correct. There are some relics that are in that bill that deal with greyhound training that probably could be deleted. It was, at that time, I felt that it was probably a good idea to have a relating to clause that would allow for some of those cleanups. We also have some Farm Bureau members who have some issues related to dwellings that they would like to see potentially some fixes for. The Farm Bureau is going to be meeting next Tuesday to discuss some of those issues. It would be housekeeping in nature also. And I'd be happy to talk about that at more depth if you'd like.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we'll close the informational hearing on LC 198, and then we'll open up informational hearing and work session for consideration of adopting bills as committee bills. So, Patrick, you want to share first with us a little bit about LC 184?
Yes, Mr. Chair. LC 184 is a memorial resolution honoring Deputy Kelly James Fredenberg, for his service. He was killed in the line of duty on June 16th, 2007. That's the purpose of that measure.
Okay. And... So why don't we go down to LC 299 and also dash 1A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 299, you should have two versions of that draft in front of you, actually. There's an LC 299 and there's also an LC 299 dash 1. We, I believe, Mr. Chair, are going to be taking motion to introduce both of those today. That's upon agreement by the parliamentarians of both Senate and House. These will be the deadlines for completion of legislative measures during the February session. The two drafts, I believe, are identical, with the exception on page 2, that there is a subsection 3 on page 2 of the 299-1 that specify that the rules of the Senate and House of Representatives apply to matters not specified in this resolution and take precedence over matters specified in this resolution.
Okay. Members, regarding this, the dash one and then also LC 299, just for your information, I think you're all aware of it, but the reason that why we're introducing two separate measures here is basically because the leadership from the House side as well as the Senate have not yet come to an agreement how we close. So that's why we're moving forward with these two versions right now. And then if, Patrick, if you'd close, and I think... Chair Kotek, you want to talk about LC 301 as well?
Certainly, Mr. Thumb.
On this topic, if I could?
Yes.
What, could you tell us what the import is of the added clause in the dash one?
Mr. Kotek, for me.
How that would change these dates, or if it would?
I'm not sure. I'm not actually prepared to answer that question, but what I would say is I believe... One of these reflects language we normally use. I believe it's the dash one,
okay,
which is that ending phrase. I'm not there seems to be disagreement of whether that's needed. I can't speak to the import. Co-Chair Olson, can you? I don't.
Well, I actually would like to have Ramona Kennedy, if she was available, to come down and explain that to us.
Okay, sounds like a complex issue. I'll withdraw my question for the time being, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
But may I
No, go ahead.
Would you still be all right with introducing it, or do you, would
oh,
you
sure.
like the clerk to come down before we...
If I may, my view about introduction of bills is that it's essentially a courtesy. I'm prepared to vote for the introduction of any bill that the chair wants introduced. I may or may not support the bill later.
Okay. Got that. And we'll have that little piece there toward the end, too.
Well, and that's precisely the attitude I take in the Revenue Committee, and it was... articulated by Representative Lane Shetterly quite some time ago, and I think it's a good policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we just take a moment here, stand at ease,
I will be right back.
It's 299. Basically, The leadership, both on the House and the Senate, have had this under conversation. They have not had an opportunity to come to an agreement on what the version should be. It has been pointed out that the difference in the resolution is subsection 3. Subsection 3 just provides some clarity on the fact that if it is not within, obviously, in my opinion, the if it's not in this resolution, obviously, House rules or Senate rules trump. But this also clarifies that House and Senate rules would trump if there was a change made there, basically, and it would trump this resolution. That being said, again, this is under conversation with the leadership. My hope is that when we walk in to convene on February 1st, the custom for the House has been to adopt the 2012 rules, regular session rules, and with that in conjunction, we adopt the resolution. And so by you providing an introduction for both vehicles will then be available, will not require any amendment at that time once leadership has agreed on what version they are going to go with for the 2012 session.
Okay, Representative.
Just a quick follow-up. Could you tell us what your view as a parliamentarian is on the question of whether the House would have the authority to change the rules in a way that contradicts this resolution if it were passed, if without the sub-3? I mean, does the House have the, let me state it a different way. Does the House still have the authority to contradict a resolution like this if it chose to do that after it had been adopted?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Barnhart, I've had conversations with our legal counsel about that. We have that under review at this point in time. I just want to make sure that before I weigh in on that with a definite answer that I've covered all the bases as it's provided that in the Constitution, each House shall determine their own rules of proceedings.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As is often the case, I'm premature, and I'll stop asking questions. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Appreciate you coming down.
No problem.
Okay.
On a more interesting note, should we talk about the next one?
Pardon?
You want to talk about LC?
Yeah, this is LC 301.
I think this is really straightforward.
Okay.
The only thing we would say is we would like to have a resolution to commemorate the Rose Bowl victory at the University of Oregon football program. There will be some slight modifications to this, so I just want to give you a heads up probably to add to the robustness of the resolution, so it won't change the intent of it. So, but
let me see how robust it is.
Mr. Chair.
Judge the robustness.
So when you see this again, it might have an amendment, so that's all.
Representative Wingert.
I'm just curious of the authors of this resolution about the date and the wording on line 10. Was 1917 chosen instead of 95 years because that just sounded better, or it just didn't want to emphasize that it had been 95 years since the University of Oregon had won a Rose Bowl?
Are you from Oregon State?
when you're doing a resolution, I think putting a date is so much more august. So we went.
Right. So because it's august.
August.
Thank you.
All right. Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The coolest thing in that football game are those helmets, and I don't see them referenced here at all.
The chrome helmets?
Yeah. Yeah. Made in Oregon chrome helmets that were just the coolest thing on the whole.
They were different.
They were cool.
Well, we are taking.
I don't see them.
We are taking consideration for amendments to the resolution.
Yes.
Yeah.
So okay. All right.
Recognize wow. Oregon design okay. And the winning uniforms. We could certainly do.
And Mr. Chair, I would also note that the football team in 1917 had the disadvantage that, quite likely, some of their best players were actually in France at the time of the game.
So were the other
good
people.
Point.
So was the other team.
That's yeah. Good. Yeah,
but
sure.
They were wearing chrome helmets, Mr.
I hope not.
Mr. Chair?
I look forward to the formal
Did Representative Barnhart report that as he was there and remember that?
Okay, we need to move on. Thank you. Okay.
Are you entertaining a motion, Mr.
I am entertaining a motion.
Chair Olson, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 183 dated January 10, 2012. LC 184 dated December 15, 2011. LC 299 dated January 17, 2012. LC 291-1 dated January 19, 2012. And LC 301 dated January 19, 2012.
Chair Kotek moves the LC 183 dated 1-10-12, LC 184 dated 12-15-11, LC 299 dated 1-17-12, LC 299-1A dated 1-19-12, and LC 301 dated 1-19-12 be adopted as committee bills. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, so we're going to close a work session on the LC's introductions, and now we have a little open up an informational hearing, and Steve Trout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director. Seems like every time I come, I get to follow the fun discussions, and hopefully I won't give you the counter here. So I was asked to give you an update on postal changes that have been in the media and how that may impact our elections this year and into the future, and then also an update on our pilot project for accessible voters up in the 1st Congressional District. So to start, obviously there's been a lot of press and different proposals regarding the post office and closing different post offices, closing regional sorting facilities, changing delivery standards, eliminating Saturday delivery. And first, just let me say that we have a great partnership with the folks at the Portland Post Office that we are working very closely with through all of these rumored and actual changes so that we can make sure that we have the most options available and can implement things in a way that will least impact our voters. And so as you may or may not have heard, one proposal is to eliminate Saturday mail delivery. We've been told that that will not happen in 2012, so that will not impact our elections this year. That requires an act of Congress, and we've been told that will not happen this year. With respect to the local post offices, while that will be an impact in the communities, we don't believe that it will impact the delivery either outbound or inbound of ballots. And so I know that initial list of 46 local post offices that was being reviewed has already been cut back, and it will not be all of those, and that they're still reviewing those. But we don't feel that that's going to have much of an impact on our election process. What has the potential to have a impact on our election process is the closing of the proposed closing of four of the six regional sorting facilities within the state. We've been I think when I spoke with you last time, there was the possibility that that would happen as early as this March. We have assurances from postal officials both locally and at the national level that no regional sorting facilities will be closed before our May 15th primary. So as far as the primary goes, we're going to be status quo and not have any issues to deal with as far as changes to mail delivery processes. For November, we don't know yet. We anticipate that more study will continue on these regional sorting facilities. Currently, they're running anywhere from 5 to 6 hours a day, and I think the plan is to consolidate these throughout the country so they're running up to 20 hours a day, which will change and give the counties more options as far as when they can drop ballots to minimize the impact of extra distances that they may have to embark on. And so we're still at a point where it's really hypotheticals as far as when this is going to happen and what's going to happen. We continue to work with the post office, come up with different ideas and ways that we can minimize the impact on our voters. And we will be meeting with postal officials with the county clerks at a conference here in the beginning of February to look at some streamlined processes that may allow for faster outbound ballots so that they would not have to travel all the way to a sorting facility if they could get pre-approved or verified is what the post office is calling it. So we're working with them. We recognize that some of the processes that that we have used historically are going to need to change, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I've urged the postal officials to consider a pilot project because we can all anticipate what the changes are going to mean, but until we actually do them, I think there's things that we will learn after the fact, and so trying to get them to do a pilot project somewhere just to see what the true impacts of that are going to be as far as ballot delivery, both on the outbound and the inbound process. So, you know, the good news is we're fine for our May primary. And then we continue to work with the counties and the post office to see what the changes will be in later in the spring, later in the summer and the fall, so that we can make whatever changes we need to so that we'll have a smooth November election. Any questions on the postal issues?
Representative Chair Kotak.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Steve, do you think, thank you for being here, and I think it's commendable. You're trying to figure out how, through your processes, you can adjust for if a regional processing facility is changed somewhere between the primary and the November election. Has your office given any thought to, you know, trying to preempt, giving you some tools, some prudent tools that if things change, you know, we have statutory guidance that we can't change once we're out of here after February, and I didn't know if. Have you given any consideration to say, pending certain circumstances, we would come back to the e-board, for example, to adjust timelines or something like that? I don't want us to get into a situation, if you're not able to come up with a better way to process and to make up for some changes at the U.S. Post Office, and then we're looking at a November presidential year and everyone's wondering, are the ballots going to hit the boxes at the right time? How do we, if we don't make changes now, I'm just trying, you know, is there a way for us to mitigate this and give you some tools so we're not having a problem if one occurs?
So, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I appreciate that, and we are looking at it. I think, you know, I keep telling people the sky is not falling. You know, we're going to be able to have an election, even if they do away with Saturday delivery and shut down all the regional sorting facilities. We're going to be able to administer elections and be able to do it successfully. What it will mean is there may be more transit time for ballots. And so we may need to tell voters, instead of the Friday before the Tuesday close of the election period, to have their ballots in the mail, to tell them Thursday or maybe Wednesday. And so that's something I think on the inbound process that we can control through just communication. What we have talked about is on the front end, because right now the mailing window by statute is from 18 to 14 days before the election. So for example, this special election in the first congressional district, ballots could be dropped on Friday, Friday the 13th. Fun, you know, fun for an election. But it also was a 3-day weekend with the Monday holiday. So if we did not have Saturday delivery, if that ends up going away and we drop our ballots on Friday, instead of voters getting them Friday and Saturday, now they're going to get them no earlier than Tuesday and Wednesday. And so voters may lose a weekend. And so we've talked about, you know, should we come and talk about backing that initial mailing date back a day or two? And we haven't come to a conclusion yet, because that also then backs up with the voter registration deadline that's set in the Constitution. So we want to make sure that, or we want to try to prevent having ballots go out before that constitutional deadline for people to register to vote. And so we're looking at that. But I'll go back to the Secretary and see if there's, you know, something that we want to put together just in case that we would want to talk about during this February session.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Thank you for checking in on this very important issue. We want to make sure that people in Oregon have an opportunity to vote. I would suggest, however, that you could always keep on your list of ideas to do away with vote for mail and go back to voting at polling places, and then we wouldn't have to worry about what the post office does.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Freeman, all ideas are on the table. I will say that as I prepare for all contingencies, I would also need to come back and present that to you, because it will cost tens of millions of dollars for us to return to that, because we would have to have voting machines in every polling place to be able to read those machines that we do not own now and have not had for over a decade now. So there will be a major fiscal impact if we were to choose to return to those. One of the nice things about having the longer period of the vote by mail is that on a stormy day like today, if today was election day, it'd be hard for a lot of people to get to the polling places. With vote by mail, you can choose to cast your ballot tomorrow or the day before, so that it's not isolated to one day. So I appreciate that, and we keep all options on the table.
Thank you.
Okay, and then if you kind of share a little bit further than Steve on that, the issue with using technology.
Sure. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Steve Trout, State Election Director. We have been looking at ways to serve our voters with different disabilities and with accessibility needs. The Help America Vote Act of 2002 required us to serve them and allow them to vote independently. And the system that we've had is now 7+ years old, and there has been new technology developed that is cheaper and has more functionality. And so we started a pilot project in the 1st Congressional District back here for the special primary in allowing voters to use different tablet devices, laptops, iPads, really any piece of hardware to be able to mark their ballot, to be able to make it bigger, to have it read to them, to be able to use their assistive devices that they use in their everyday life to be able to mark these ballots, print them out, and then have them mailed in just like every other ballot, so that we've got a piece of paper that comes in that runs through the tally machine. We had good success with our test during the special primary. I think we had 89 voters use the new tools. We are expanding that test as we speak to those voters in the 1st Congressional District. One function that we are going to try that we didn't in the first round is what's called a ballot on demand printer, so that these ballots that are marked that the voting machines won't read currently, they're just printed out on a regular piece of paper, they have a barcode on them that this ballot on demand printer can read and produce on the spot a machine readable ballot. So what would happen is you would enter this piece of paper that the voter filled out and into the machine, and instead of having human beings duplicate the ballot, which is always a difficult process after you've been working long days, we have a machine do it, prints it out on the back end, and then the duplication boards will take that ballot that was printed out from the machine, compare it to the original source document to make sure it accurately reflects the voter's intent and their markings, and then we'll send that through. So we think that will speed up the process, reduce some of the human errors that are inherent in the duplication process, and allow us to be able to be more efficient in processing those ballots.
Now, are you're just doing this pilot project in one county?
Actually, we're doing it in all five.
Oh, okay.
We have just one ballot on demand printer just in Washington County for that test. We didn't want to. It's being loaned to us for the test to see if it will work and if it will give the benefits that have been advertised and we expect it to.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks. We'll see you next month.
Thanks,
all right.
Steve.
Okay. All right, we're going to close the informational hearing, and we are adjourned.